Hey, this is Dave DeCamp from AntiWar.com. This is Anti-War News for Wednesday, May 1st, 2024. Alright, I want to start off again today reminding everybody that we're doing our fundraiser at AntiWar.com. We're trying to reach our goal of $100,000. We have $40,000 in matching funds, which means we have to raise the same amount to get that money. So right now, if you go to antiwar.com/donate, you can see the different ways that you can support us. And if you like this show, if you appreciate what I do, it would not be possible without antiwar.com. It would not be possible without our readers supporting us and funding us. That's the way antiwar.com has done it since the 1990s, and we continue today. We really appreciate all the support so far. Anybody that has donated, I really appreciate it. So again, antiwar.com/donate to help keep this show and keep antiwar.com going so we can cover all this stuff that's been going on. I mean, it's been real crazy. It's been real crazy lately. All right, so the first story at the top of antiwar.com today, Israel to invade Rafah with or without a hostage deal. So Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu vowed on Tuesday that Israel will invade the southern Gaza city of Rafah with or without a hostage deal with Hamas. And this is a threat that I believe could derail the ceasefire negotiations. So Netanyahu said at a meeting with representatives of hostage families, quote, "The idea that we will halt the war before achieving all of its goals is out of the question. We will enter Rafah and we will eliminate the Hamas battalions there with or without a deal in order to achieve the total victory," end quote. So as I've been covering a lot lately, the situation in Rafah, there's over a million Palestinian civilians packed in there. We see whenever Israel launches airstrikes there, they kill lots of civilians, lots of children are killed. And any invasion, of course, there would be huge civilian casualties. An evacuation isn't really feasible since so much of Gaza is obliterated. But Netanyahu and Israeli officials continue to threaten this invasion. And I believe what Netanyahu's doing here is trying to derail the negotiations with Hamas. Hamas is currently preparing its written response to Israel's latest proposal in these Egyptian and Qatari mediated talks. And according to the reports, one thing that Israel said in its response was that it was willing to discuss a restoration of sustainable calm after an initial hostage and prisoner exchange, which that is being portrayed as, is being reported as a concession toward Hamas's demand for a permanent ceasefire. Hamas has been very clear that they'll release all the hostages in exchange for a permanent ceasefire or steps in that direction. So here there's a signal. I mean, it's very vague language, but it still is, it does represent a little bit of a change in what Israel has been saying. So then here you have Netanyahu say, no matter what, we're going to invade Rafah. There will be no permanent ceasefire, is what he's saying. And according to CNN, this was interesting. So this deal apparently that's on the table would be for the first phase would be a 40-day ceasefire and the release of as many as 33 Israeli hostages in exchange for the release of Palestinian prisoners. I'm not sure exactly how many. But according to CNN, and I saw this reported elsewhere, Israel and Egypt crafted this proposal together, and I saw some Israeli officials call it an Egyptian proposal that Israel, shouldn't go for. And CNN reported that Israel has not fully agreed to the proposal, so that Israel hasn't even fully agreed to what they proposed to Hamas. So even if Hamas comes back and says that they'll go for it, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to be a deal. But I think Netanyahu is hoping that Hamas comes back with something so then he can say, oh, that's it. They're totally unreasonable. We're going through with the invasion of Rafah. All right, so the next one here, Smotrich calls for total annihilation of Gaza cities. So Israeli Finance Minister Bezalel Smotrich on Monday called for the total annihilation of Rafah and other cities in the Gaza Strip. Smotrich said, quote, "There are no half measures. Rafah, Deir al-Balah, Nusrat, total annihilation. You will blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven. There's no place under heaven," end quote. So his reference to Amalek there is from a line in Deuteronomy, a book in the Hebrew Bible. And Amalek is a nation that the ancient Israelites were commanded to destroy. And in the book of Samuel, the Israelites were told to slay both man and woman, infant, and suckling. And we've seen Netanyahu refer to Amalek before too, compare Gaza to Amalek. And this has been cited as evidence of genocidal rhetoric in South Africa's case against Israel at the International Court of Justice. And, you know, these are Bible parts of the Bible that are very, you know, people, Christians and Jews usually are hesitant to talk about because it's kind of a difficult topic to explain, to understand. But here you have these Israeli officials frequently using it. I think some other officials have said it as well, pointing to one of the most violent parts of the Bible and comparing it to what they're doing in Gaza. And of course, the annihilation of Rafah would mean the death of over 1 million civilians who are sheltering there. And Smotrich also said that any hostage deal with Hamas would be a humiliating defeat for Israel. He said, quote, "Don't wave a white flag. Don't let Sinwar humiliate us again and win the war. A government that submits to international pressure and stops the war in the middle will, at the moment, lose its right to exist," end quote. So he also called for the destruction of Hezbollah in Lebanon, saying that Israel must, quote, "clear out, with God's help, one blow, wicked Hezbollah in the north, and really send a message that what will happen to those who harm the Jewish people is the same as those who have tried to harm us in the past. They will be destroyed, 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 and it will echo for decades to come," end quote. So Smotrich, besides being the finance minister, has a minister position that puts him in charge of the West Bank. And he's an Israeli settler and wants to expel all the Palestinians from the West Bank. I mean, he's really the worst of the worst when it comes to Israeli politics, and he has a very influential and powerful position. And I know Smotrich and Ben-Gvir are putting a lot of pressure on Netanyahu not to agree to any sort of deal. All right, so the next one here. The ICJ allows Nicaragua case against Germany to proceed. So this is a different case at the ICJ. This article is from Middle East Eye. Nicaragua opened a case against Germany for arming Israel, saying that it's complicit in genocide. So the International Court of Justice, the ICJ, has rejected a German request to throw out the Nicaraguan case, accusing it of facilitating Israel's genocide in Gaza, allowing the case to proceed. The presiding judge, Nawaf Salam, who delivered the World Court's decision on Tuesday, said that the ICJ remains, quote, "deeply concerned about the catastrophic living conditions of the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip," end quote. However, the court ruled by 15-1 against issuing any emergency measures against Germany over its arms exports to Israel, arguing that the current circumstances do not require them. The ICJ reminded all parties that they are obligated to respect and ensure respect to Article 1 of the Geneva Convention. Germany said that they welcome the ruling, even though they're not throwing out the case. So this doesn't mean that Germany's not going to be found guilty of facilitating, you know, supporting genocide by arming Israel. Nicaragua brought Germany before the ICJ for violating the Genocide Convention and international law through its continued military and political support of Israel. During a two-day hearing, Nicaragua accused Germany of facilitating the commission of genocide, demanding the court impose emergency measures to halt German arms exports to Israel and reinstate funding for the UN Palestinian Relief Agency. And of course, Germany rejected the charges. So no emergency orders, but the case will continue. All right, so the next one here. U.S. troops on Gaza pier could shoot back. So there was a very interesting exchange on Tuesday between Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin and Matt Gaetz, a Republican House representative from Florida. So Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin acknowledged on Tuesday that it was a possibility that the 1,000 U.S. troops deployed off the coast of Gaza as part of a project to build a pier could come under fire, and said that they would be able to shoot back. Austin made these comments in an exchange with Gaetz. He said, quote, "They have the right to return fire to protect themselves," end quote. And when he was asked by Gaetz if it was likely that U.S. troops would come under attack from someone in Gaza, Austin said that it is possible. And we know that the staging area for the pier has already come under mortar attack. No one was hurt. Only minor damage was reported. But this is definitely a big risk of escalation here with the U.S. building this pier. Because, of course, Hamas and other Palestinian militant groups in Gaza view the U.S. as a party to the conflict, since it provides most of the bombs that are being dropped on Gaza. And the U.S. also provides intelligence sharing and, of course, all the political support. You know, it goes beyond just arming Israel. The U.S. relationship and support with Israel, it's very strong. And they're really the only country that continues to stick by them, you know, at the UN and on the world stage. Austin insisted that there would be no U.S. boots on the ground in Gaza, but Gaetz said the pier deployment was not much different than putting troops in the Strip. Gaetz said, quote, "I think you're going to find the American people have a different perspective on that. And if we're going to have people shooting into Gaza, we probably should have a vote on that pursuant to our own war powers," end quote. The U.S. is expected to spend at least $320 million on the pier, and Biden ordered the construction to allow more aid into the Strip instead of pressuring Israel to open more land border crossings. So the way that this is going to work is that the pier that they're building is actually going to be a few miles anchored off Gaza's coast, and that's going to receive shipments from Cyprus. And then the aid will be delivered to smaller U.S. Army boats that will take it to the causeway attached to the shore of Gaza. So that's going to be where so U.S. Army boats are going to be taking it to this causeway that's actually on the shore. So that's a big risk right there, basically being right off the coast of Gaza. And then trucks driven by an unnamed partner country would pick up the aid and drive it down the 100-meter-long causeway. So where the U.S. Army boats are pulling up is only going to be 300 feet away from Gaza's coast. So that very, you know, in range of all sorts of weapons there. And the U.S. military published photos of the pier being built on Tuesday, and U.S. officials say that they expect it to be operational by next week. So definitely some big risks. And, you know, there's always the question of what could this pier be used for? Is it just going to be for aid, or is there some sort of nefarious purpose? And one thing that people suspect is that they're going to try to deport Palestinians through that pier. And this next one here, the White House considers taking in Palestinian refugees from Gaza. So CBS reported that the Biden administration is considering taking in certain Palestinian refugees and giving them a permanent safe haven in the United States. The report said that officials across several government agencies are examining options to resettle Palestinians who have immediate family members who are American citizens or permanent residents. They are also considering making the option available for Palestinians with any relatives who are Americans. The number of Palestinians eligible for permanent resettlement in the U.S. is expected to be relatively small, but the report said it would mark the first time that the U.S. refugee program accepts Palestinians in large numbers. And this is, could provide an escape for some Palestinians. And I know some Palestinians in the U.S. who are trying to get their families out. But this could also play into Israel's hopes of cleansing the Gaza Strip of its Palestinian population, which I believe is the Israeli government's ultimate goal here. And I kind of just compile the evidence for that at the end of this article. We had the intelligence ministry document that was leaked way back in October. It said the best case scenario for Israel is to expel all 2.3 million Palestinians in Gaza into Egypt. Egypt's not going to let that happen. So the Israelis started looking elsewhere. There was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal written by two members of the Israeli Knesset, one from the Likud party, so the ruling party, and one from Yesh Atid, which is the main opposition party. And they were saying Western countries should take in Palestinian refugees. And I know there's been talk of sending a few, you know, a few hundred thousand here, a few tens of thousand there, to spread them out. And the Israeli intelligence minister has said that one option for Gaza is to promote the voluntary resettlement of Palestinians. And Netanyahu has also reportedly said, this was back in December, that he was looking for countries to absorb Palestinians. And Israeli officials frame this as voluntary resettlement, but let's be realistic here. The Israeli bombing campaign and siege on Gaza has made much of the enclave uninhabitable and could give Palestinians no choice, you know, if they have the option to leave in this, in that situation, you know, they might not have a choice depending on their situation, even knowing that they're not going to be able to go back to their homes. Because, you know, once they leave, Israel's not letting them back in. I mean, that's just the reality. So I would think, you know, if the U.S. starts doing this, that other Western countries might do it as well. And then it could lead to some substantial numbers of Palestinians leaving, whether voluntarily or forced. All right. So the next one here, Democratic Party's College Group backs protests and criticizes Biden. So this is interesting. The College Democrats of America, excuse me, the official college outreach arm of the Democratic National Committee has come out strongly in support of students at college campuses across the country protesting against the Israeli slaughter of Palestinians in Gaza. So the group said in a statement, quote, "This past week, we witnessed heroic actions on the part of students around the country to protest and sit in for an end to the war in Palestine and the release of the hostages. Since the beginning of this conflict, college Democrats and students from every walk of life have had the moral clarity to see this war for what it is, destructive, genocidal, and unjust," end quote. So this is the official, again, Democratic Party, Democratic National Committee, college outreach group is calling this genocidal. And the group also condemned the crackdown on the protests that we've seen at the colleges, the administrators, you know, calling in the police to break these things up. I know in Richmond, Richmond's kind of the closest big city to me, the college VCU had pro-Palestine protesters at the library on Monday, just for one day. And at night, the police came and tear gassed them and broke it up. And I mean, you know, there's a history of college students protesting things and having sit-ins and things. And they're, you know, they're really cracking down on these particular protests. So this group has endorsed President Biden for the 2024 election, but it criticized Biden's policy of unconditional support and the refusal to call for a ceasefire. Of course, Biden has smeared the protesters as anti-Semitic, despite Jewish participation in the protests. And on Tuesday, the White House condemned the takeover of a campus building at Columbia University. So the group said, quote, "As college Democrats, we are committed to the re-election of President Biden and Democrats across down ballot races in every corner of our nation. However, as representatives of youth across the country, we reserve the right to criticize our own party when it fails to represent youth voices. As young voters, we are well aware that come November, our votes will determine who wins the White House. The White House has taken the mistaken route of a bear hug strategy for Netanyahu and a cold shoulder strategy for its own base and all Americans who want to see an end to the war," end quote. And it also says that each day Democrats fail to stand for a ceasefire, that they're going to find more and more youth disillusioned with the party. So Biden, despite the dissent that he's faced within the Democratic Party, within his own campaign team, within the administration, there's no sign this is going to make him change, even though it could cost him the election in November. All right, so the next one here, State Department official resigns and says that the U.S. is inciting attacks on U.S. troops. So this article is from Kyle Anzalone at the Libertarian Institute. And it says the State Department's former Arabic language spokeswoman says she resigned from her post after official talking points became too provocative. Halal Rahrit said that the White House policy was potentially provoking attacks on U.S. troops and explained that she refused to do Arabic interviews starting in October because she did not want to be the reason why someone hates America more. So very interesting things that she had to say. And I believe she's the third U.S. State Department official to resign. She said that the talking points produced by the Biden administration were very provocative, you know, to an Arabic speaking audience, and oftentimes completely ignored the Palestinians and was all about Israel's right to defend itself. She said, quote, "I, in good conscience, could not go on Arab television with those talking points. All that would have done is have caused someone to want to throw their shoe at the TV, want to burn an American flag, or worse, throw a rocket at our troops," end quote. So again, very interesting. She did another interview and said, quote, "From the get-go, I refuse to do, as a spokesperson in the region, I refuse to do interviews on Gaza. Not because I personally disagreed with the policy, but because I documented how this policy was undermining U.S. interests in the Arab world. How we were being called out for a double standard and how people across the region saw through our talking points and no longer believed us for a lack of credibility. I was documenting how I was causing a backlash," end quote. All right, so the next one here, moving into Ukraine. Ukraine attacks Crimea with U.S.-provided attackums. So Russian officials said on Tuesday that Ukraine targeted Crimea with U.S.-provided army tactical missile systems known as attackums. And these are long-range missiles that the U.S. secretly provided Ukraine in March. So the attackums that the U.S. shipped to Ukraine have a range of about 190 miles, and it's a big escalation when it comes to U.S. support. The U.S. sent an older version of the attackums last fall that could hit targets up to 100 miles away, but those were cluster bombs. So to me, that was equally, maybe not equally, but almost as insane as sending the longer range version. So the governor of Crimea said that the attackums were shot down by Russian air defenses in the attack on Tuesday. The Russian Defense Ministry said that it shot down a total of 6 attackums, but did not specify where. So, of course, U.S.-supported attacks on Crimea always risk a major escalation, as the peninsula is considered a red line for Putin. And this is something that Blinken has acknowledged. And a U.S. official told Reuters that Ukraine launched its first attack on Crimea using attackums on April 17th. And, you know, we see the attitude. We've seen this throughout the war. The U.S. or some other NATO countries rule out sending a certain type of weapon because they're worried it would be too escalatory. But then as time goes on, they say, well, Putin hasn't bombed a NATO base yet. Well, he hasn't used a tactical nuke on Kiev yet. Well, you know, we could just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And that's the attitude. And that's why they started sending these missiles. And then this was, you know, this is as the U.S. is announcing all these new weapons packages, you know, $7 billion so far that they released from that new $61 billion bill. All right, so the next one here, the Houthis restarted attacks after reviewing U.S. incentives. So there is a report from The National, which is a UAE state-owned newspaper, that said the Houthis restarted attacks on shipping in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden last week after examining incentives put forward by the U.S. So if you remember at the beginning of April, Tim Lenderking, who's the U.S. special envoy for Yemen, he said that the U.S. was considering diplomacy with the Houthis after a months-long bombing campaign failed to deter them, and it only escalated the situation. So sources told The National that the U.S. offered a lifting of the blockade on the capital of Yemen, Sana'a, and on the Red Sea port of Hodeidah, which has been imposed since 2015, since the U.S.-backed Saudi-UAE coalition intervened in Yemen in an attempt to oust the Houthis, which of course failed. Very brutal war included siege warfare, you know, with the blockade. The blockade has been eased, but it still hasn't been fully lifted. airstrikes on civilian infrastructure, very similar to what Israel's done to Gaza, but not as concentrated. You know, it's not as small of a concentrated place. The report said that the U.S. also offered to hasten Yemen peace talks. Not sure exactly what that means, but the U.S. did recently impose sanctions on the Houthis to block the implementation of a Saudi-Houthi peace deal that would have lifted the blockade. So that's what these sources told The National, and The Cradle previously reported that the U.S. also offered an acknowledgement of the Houthis' legitimacy, which sounds like recognition. They are the governing force, the governing power in the area where most Yemenis live, what used to be North Yemen, the country of North Yemen. And they've controlled the capital since 2014. So they're not the Houthi rebels, as everybody calls them. They are the governing force. And their official name, of course, is Ansar Allah. The Houthis have rejected the U.S. incentives, and they're sticking to their position that the Red Sea operations won't stop until the Israeli siege on Gaza comes to an end. Lender King has acknowledged that he thinks the Houthis would be true to their word. So the U.S. thinks if there was a ceasefire in Gaza, the Houthis would stop, but the U.S. is still refusing to call for a ceasefire or pressure Israel into stopping. A Yemeni political source told The National, quote, "The Houthis have received many incentives since the start of the operations in the Red Sea, but they are concluding that what's being offered isn't enough to stop. They are seeing these offers as blackmail in the humanitarian file because the issue of opening the airport or port or bringing in necessary needs is a right of the Yemenis and should not be used as a pressure card on Sana'a," end quote. And it's interesting to see. So the National, UAE, state-funded, state-owned newspaper, sort of portraying the Houthis in a good light, you know, because for the longest time, Saudi UAE media, very, you know, because they're fighting a war against them, you know, you would notice, you know, how they covered the Houthis, and this, I just thought was interesting. I just noticed it portrayed them more in a kind of a positive light here almost. All right, so the last story here, the U.S.-Japan-Philippines alliance stokes tensions with China. So this article is from the South China Morning Post. Really, I put this in because there was another incident between the Chinese and Philippine vessels in the South China Sea. There was another showdown at the Scarborough Shoal. I believe it was the Scarborough Shoal. Yeah, and this is there's often these encounters, and it ended with Chinese boats firing water cannons at the Philippine vessels, and this happens a lot now. And this is kind of an analysis from the South China Morning Post, just talking about how the U.S. is trying to forge this three-way alliance between the U.S., Philippines, and Japan, and how that's adding to the tensions, because there was this showdown with the Philippines, which again happens pretty often. And this comes as the U.S. and the Philippines are conducting their big military drills in the South China Sea. So the reason why I try to cover this is because the U.S. Philippine Mutual Defense Treaty, the U.S. says that it applies to attacks on Philippine vessels in the South China Sea. So if this ever turns into a shooting war, the U.S. is saying it's going to intervene. So this is a flashpoint for war with China. And then the way that the Japan is brought into this here is that there is another kind of, I don't know if you would call it a showdown, but China and Japan also have overlapping claims over in the East China Sea, the Senkaku Islands, or they're known as the Diu Islands in China. Some Japanese lawmakers visited those islands on Saturday, and that was seen kind of as provocative toward China. That's what China said, that it was provocative, and they sent vessels to confront the provocative move in the East China Sea, and they also lodged a protest with the Japanese government. These are islands that have been disputed for a while, and I know in 2012, Japan nationalized the islands, and you know, that was something that really kind of kicked off more of a dispute over them. And this is another place, the Senkaku Islands in the East China Sea, that are also claimed by Taiwan. You know, they're very far from Japan. The U.S. has committed to defending these islands. This is one of the first things Biden told Japan when he became president was, we will defend the Senkaku Islands. I mean, it's just, there's not an island or a reef in the area that the U.S. isn't willing to go to war over, it seems like. Remember, Biden just hosted Marcos and Kishida, the Philippine president and the Japanese prime minister, in Washington to kind of forge this three-way alliance. And this is all aimed at China. You know, it's very clearly they're doing this in the name of China being the biggest threat, according to Kishida, that they've ever faced. So, of course, China is going to respond to this type of stuff. All right, so that is it for the news for today. Please go check out our viewpoints. We have a very interesting piece here from Gregor Batzak. It's an interview with former Ambassador Jack Matlock, who was the last U.S. ambassador to the Soviet Union. And he talks about a lot of really interesting things with Ukraine related to negotiations, you know, with the Soviet Union towards the end of the Cold War, how he says, you know, they told him they're not going to expand NATO. And his view on the current things of, he says it's foolish to be making China into an enemy and continuing this proxy war in Ukraine. So it's really interesting. He's always has very interesting things to say, and he's asked a lot of good questions. So please go check that out. We have one from Ted Snyder. Despite media cheerleading, $61 billion won't beat Russia. One from Ramzi Baroud, the ideological coup, how disciples of Kahane became the new face of Israel. One from Brian McGlinchey, World War II did not end the Great Depression. And our spotlight from Aaron Mate, what 10 years of meddling in Ukraine wrought. So please go check all that out. And again, it's our fundraiser, so help us with that if you can. You could also help us by sharing this show, telling your friends about antiwar.com. Like, subscribe, comment, follow us on Instagram, follow us on X, follow me over there too. But I will be back tomorrow with some more news. Thanks for listening.